Floodlines is a firsthand account of community, culture, and resistance in New Orleans in the years before and after Hurricane Katrina by Jordan Flaherty. Instead of a traditional book tour, Jordan has helped organize the Community and Resistance Tour, which seeks to communicate about current struggles for justice and liberation. The tour also seeks to connect communities of liberation and to build relationships between grassroots activists and independent media.
The movement there and the way social justice organizing works there is really different, and I think it's really positive how it works there, and I think there's been a lot of successes.
The support that we've received so far from the community has really, really lifted our spirits, made us very proud of ourselves and proud of them, and we hope it continues. Power to the people.
Wherever I am, I'm certainly going to be a cultural ambassador, you know, for the city to bring a light to every injustice, and even bring a light to, you know, all of the stories of hope and victory and resiliency that go on every day and every moment.
Tonight on Circle A Radio, we'll speak to Jordan Flaherty. We'll listen to audio from the Community and Resistance Tour, and we'll hear from other contributors to the book and other people who were involved in the tour. Stay tuned.
We begin with Jordan Flaherty, who was in Portland Sunday, October 17th, 2010.
My name's Jordan Flaherty, and I'm a journalist based in New Orleans. I also work with an organization called Louisiana Justice Institute, and I'm the author of the book Floodlines, Community and Resistance from Katrina to the Gina Six. And what I've tried to do with this book is to lift up these stories of grassroots organizing that's happened in New Orleans and try to multiply and amplify the voices of these struggles. I think have been, again, really incredible and really inspiring. And I think that there's so much for people who work on these issues anywhere to really learn from these struggles and from these voices and from the incredible work that people at the grassroots have done in New Orleans. There's a consensus among a lot of people in this country over what the problems are, but there's not enough talk over what the solutions are, not enough examples of hope that people can have, that people have had successes in these struggles. So the idea of this tour was different organizers, artists, activists, people coming from different perspectives, different movement, but everyone talking about ways in which they've successfully struggled on these issues and to try to inspire more people to get involved in these movements and for people to move these movements forward and not just keep doing the same thing, but try innovative and new tactics and try to win some real justice.
Who was initially involved in the conversation that this sprung from?
Part of it came out of this project called the Grassroots Media Tour that some of the same folks were involved in, including Jesse Muhammad, a journalist from the Final Call newspaper who lives in Houston. But also there was the brilliant poet Alexis Pauline Gums that was part of it, and Puck Lowe, who's a radio and sometimes print journalist. Those were some of the folks that were involved in some of the earlier conversations on it.
We'll now hear from Jesse Muhammad, a journalist and organizer who spoke during the Community and Resistance Tour. Here's an excerpt from his speech he gave at the Amherst University in September of this year.
As introduced earlier, my name is Jesse Muhammad, or you can call me Brother Jesse. I'm honored to be here. I'm a staff writer for the Final Call newspaper. The Final Call newspaper, for those that aren't familiar, is headquartered in Chicago, Illinois. It's published by the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan and the Nation of Islam, and it's actually the only remaining Black-owned, nationally distributed newspaper that's left in the country. Due to the economy, most of them have shut down, or they either went local, or they don't exist anymore, or they went straight to online. So the Final Call is the only one that is left. I'm honored to be as a staff writer. I'm also an award-winning blogger, photographer, and I just love being in the presence of all of the young leaders, as well as the younger leaders. My task here tonight is to get down to serious business. What I want to give to you today, I came all the way from Houston. This is my first time in Massachusetts, my first time particularly in this town. This is my first time speaking at an Ivy League school, but this is not my first time talking about the serious business of the Gina Six. How many of us are familiar with the case of the Gina Six? I want to talk to you about some of the behind the scenes of what went down with that. And then I'm going to give you five, what's called the five P's of organizing that you can get out of this case that you can apply on anything that you're going to organize in your life going forward. How did I get involved with the Gina 6? Well, I was at home, somebody sent me a text message. They say, Brother Jesse, you heard about these six black boys in Gina, Louisiana? They was involved in a school fight. They got locked up and they have $140,000 bail. I sat down with the parents of these six boys and they sat down and told me what happened. Now, evidently there was this white tree at the school, Gina, Louisiana, 4,000 people, majority white. And one of the students asked, could they sit under the white tree? Black students. Administrators say fine. They sat under it. The next day they come back, three nooses hanging from the tree. We love the fact that the families had already organized themselves. They didn't wait for no big celebrity, no entertainer to back them up. They had already organized themselves into an NAACP chapter. They had already got with the ACLU. So they wanted to host a rally in July of 2007, and we said we would come back. We at the jailhouse protesting. There's 300 of us. We 300 deep. This was the largest protest in Gina history. 300 people. We almost got 300 in here. So I walk up and it's this white guy. He going off on the megaphone. I mean, cranking it up. I'm like, man, who is this? I go around. It's Jordan. He on the megaphone. I know he look mild mannered and everything, but he like, we gonna shut this city down and this and everybody crump. So now. We about to march it out now. Now, Gina, Louisiana is so big, all they got is a post office, they got one store, they got the Gina Times newspaper, and the jail cell. The rest is just trees. So by the time we said no justice, no, the rally was over with. We had already marched the whole time. So one guy said, well, let's march it again. Like, nah, hold on, man, it's kind of hot out here. But the point is, we had made a statement. People were upset. 300 people. You wouldn't think that would make a difference, but that's big for that town, so they got shook up. So what they banked on is that there would be no follow-up from that. Because you know why? The reason we always lose with our movements is because we have no follow-up. We do one-day events. We feel good, but what's next? So I was in that I don't want no next mode. When I got home, I was tired. I'm gonna lay down. I'm gonna watch me some cartoons on Saturday morning, eat me some cereal, I'm chilling. Well, I start getting text messages from students from TSU, Prairie View, UT, U of H, Sam Houston, Tulane, Morehouse, Spelman, Brother Jesse, what's next? I'm like, what's next? Can we just save it a moment? We brought about 50,000 now. You remember that was just 24 hours ago. I'm tired. I walked 15 miles back. Like, do you remember that when they was buses? Now, they did this purposely, too. When the rally was over with, they was letting buses back in Gina, one bus every 45 minutes to pick us up. So I laid in the sun for 3 hours on a poster board waiting on our bus to come back. And you talking about what's next? Sleep is next. So as I closed, I was talking to the students. I said, you know what, Brother Jesse? We can't let this just dwindle away. Because why? Next thing we know, after the Gina rally, more little small Gina start popping up. Everybody start reporting, nooses here, nooses there, fire department, a noose on the back of a truck, a noose in Philly. Next thing you know, people in these small towns that's usually afraid, they start getting the courage to want to start contacting us. Hey, we got this going on, we got this going on. It just set fire. So I challenged some students, not knowing that they were going to actually do it. I said, you know what? Somebody with all of their intellect need to take the case of the Gina 6 and write a thesis as a model for organizing. I didn't know somebody was actually going to do it. Well, they did it. And this is what they came up with, several students, the 5 P's of organizing. I want to share it with you. And you may write it down if you choose to. These are the 5 P's of organizing that they came up with out of this. So that's people, purpose, propaganda, performance, and you got to have procedure. And my last thing I close to the students. I went to college. Prairie View A&M University, which is in Prairie View, Texas, 45 minutes outside of Houston. I was blessed that when I entered those doors of that school, I had already had in my mind that my education went beyond just the four walls of my class. And I understood that my education and purpose was to serve something higher than just getting a good job, to uphold somebody else's ideas, But my education was the cultivation of self so I can serve my fellow man and rock this world by leaving my footprint by doing something greater than just saying I had a 4.0. So I would say the same thing to you. Don't just say that I got an education just so you can have that piece of paper on your wall. But what's the substance behind it? Thank you all.
That was Jesse Muhammad, journalist and radical organizer from Houston, Texas. We now go back to Jordan Flaherty from an interview conducted by Teresa Mitchell.
I had just moved to New Orleans a few years before Hurricane Katrina, and during the storm, I was in the mid-city neighborhood. And right after the storm, you know, we felt like we dodged a bullet, like the city was okay. You know, the hurricane itself did not do the damage to New Orleans, but the levees, which were built by the Army Corps of Engineers, which were supposed to hold up to a storm even more powerful than Katrina, failed to hold up. And so the water began flooding into the city. And over the next 24 hours, we saw the water rising and knew that something had gone terribly wrong. But what really shaped my life and what really devastated me, and even as someone who is very critical of the U.S. government, I was really shocked by what I saw was, first of all, the real lack of rescue over the following days. But then when I did evacuate and went through an evacuee camp just outside of town and saw people in the camp, overwhelmingly African-American, mostly poor and working class folks, have guns pointed at them by National Guard soldiers. I saw families getting separated as people were put onto buses. I saw people were not even told where the bus was going, whether it was going to Baton Rouge or to Texas or to Oklahoma. You know, that information was just not given to people. And then when I got out of the city and saw the media coverage and saw how the corporate media had started depicting people as criminals, as looters, as thugs, as armed gangs. You had Chris Lawrence on CNN saying there's no normal people left in the city, only armed ones. Our own governor at the time, Kathleen Blanco, said, "I'm sending in National Guard troops. They're locked and loaded. They've been trained to shoot to kill, and I expect they will." So in the building I was in, you know, there was it was a large building. It wasn't actually the building I lived in, but we were staying in a friend of a friend's house. So it was a kind of large, sturdy structure that we thought would be pretty safe in a hurricane. And so there was hundreds of people in this building. It was called the American Can Company, you know, former industrial building that had been turned into apartments. And there was a mix of white folks and African-American folks in the building. And you know, days went by and there was just no rescue. There was no help coming. People were seeing some helicopters in the sky, but no one was coming to help, which I think people had similar experiences all around the city. And part of what I talk about is similar stories that people faced around the city of just there being for days and days no help. And there was in the building a former Marine named John Keller, who tells a story of how he was, you know, in the building and seeing, you know, no help arriving, seeing people hungry, seeing people, you know, running out of food and water and seeing these helicopters pass and no one helping. And he got the idea of telling all the African Americans in the building to go inside and, you know, including himself, and just leaving white folks on the roof. And after he did that, within about a half hour, suddenly helicopter came and brought help and began the process of evacuating people.
I think you said within 20 minutes.
Yeah, I think that's about right. And, you know, you could just say, oh, well, you know, that's just a coincidence or whatever. But, you know, the thing is, similar stories happen all around the city. For example, in the Ritz-Carlton Hotel, you had an incredibly shocking situation where the people were evacuated out of this hotel, and the mostly African-American staff and some of the African-American guests were evacuated to the Superdome on one bus, while mostly the white guests were evacuated out of town and into safety on another bus. So you had this incredibly racialized rescue where all around the city people were seeing just very different experiences for white folks and for African-Americans in their rescue. Just incredibly shocking and just stories you would not expect in this era.
You bring that out really well in the book, which leads to the next question. How did white male privilege aid you in investigating and disseminating the truth, and how did it obstruct your efforts?
Well, definitely in my work, I've been really inspired by the work of an organization in New Orleans called the People's Institute for Survival and Beyond. That's an anti-racist training organization. And as a white person who moved to New Orleans a few years before the storm, I want to be really real about my privilege and the way it's interacted with my work. One thing the People's Institute says is that if you're an organizer or media maker and you're getting more skills, if you're not also challenging racism in yourself and in society, then you're just becoming a more skillful racist. And so I think it's really crucial to be really honest about race and racism. And I think it's affected my life every day, certainly in the recovery. And instead of being put on one of these buses where I didn't even know where I was going, I was able to get a ride from an Australian TV crew that then took me to Baton Rouge. And from there, I got a ride from family members of a friend of mine, and I was actually able to get back in the city again, basically through white privilege, within the next couple of weeks. Also, just in every day in New Orleans, I see it in policing. You know, I'll bike around the city and think nothing of bicycling through a red light right in front of a police car. And yet, in the criminal justice work I've done, I've seen many stories of young African American men who have been arrested and literally spent months in jail for riding their bike one-handed.
That's incredible.
But
it's so true.
Petty things that are not even technically crimes, I think, but people have been arrested for them. And so it definitely interacts with things every day. And I think it's part of why I'm writing this book is, you know, as a white person in New Orleans, speak out about the ways in which race privilege interacts with our life in the city.
You are listening to Jordan Flaherty on Circle A Radio. That was an interview done by Teresa Mitchell on October 14th, 2010. Now we hear Jordan from an interview at KABU done on October 17th.
Living in New Orleans in this period, although it's been incredibly difficult and very sad sometimes, it's also filled me with so much hope. I feel like I didn't really know what community meant until I lived in New Orleans, this city where it can take 2 hours to walk just a few blocks because you're talking to people on every porch, and where if someone asks you how you're doing, they really wait for an answer, and where everyone's always trying to feed you, and where everyone, men and women, young and old, calls each other baby. It's a really different environment, and I feel like the movement there and the way social justice organizing works there is really different, and I think it's really positive how it works there. And I think there's been a lot of successes of these periods of the past few years. We're looking at a real change in the police department that's happening. There's an independent monitor over the police department. There's a complete change in the Indigent Defense Board, the public defender's office. So we've seen major changes, and it's really been because of grassroots pressure and grassroots organizing. So I think that there are models that can really be replicated and that should be amplified and multiplied.
How about giving us some of the examples of those?
Well, you know, again, on this issue of policing, in that period after Katrina, at first people felt sympathy for people in New Orleans, saw them on rooftops at the convention and Superdome, but then suddenly that conversation changed and people were criminals, they were looters, they were thugs. That's how the media was depicting people. Our governor said, "I'm sending in National Guard troops. They're locked and loaded. They've been trained to shoot to kill, and I expect they will." So suddenly people were criminalized. But right in that same period, people really start organizing around this issue. So, for example, this organization, Safe Streets, Strong Communities, was founded. And the first thing they did was they went into the shelters and were talking to people in the shelters about their experience. Then they went into the jails and were talking to people in the jails and found out about how people had been in Orleans Parish Prison as the water was rising and were left for dead. They found out about this Indigent Defense Board that was not interested in defending people where most of the lawyers didn't even know their clients' names, much less any facts about their case, where one of the lawyers was known to be doing his crossword puzzles while he was sitting there in court, supposed to be representing his clients. Then Safe Streets went into the neighborhoods, and once people started coming back, and went door to door and built a base in the community and built an organization that was accountable to and directed by that community. And they used multiple tactics. They pushed in the city council. They pushed in the state legislature. They pushed on a federal level. They wrote reports. They pushed in the media. They went to the district attorney, to the U.S. attorney. And that's how they started winning these victories of winning an independent monitor over a police department, winning complete overhaul of the Indigent Defense Board. So because they were able to build this organization that was accountable to and built from the base, and because they struggled on these multiple different avenues and through multiple different tactics at once, they were able to win real successes. The public housing movement also was really led by the people in public housing, and it involved direct action where people moved into these public housing units that were scheduled for demolition and were living in them as a form of direct action, but also involved lobbying. It also involved lawsuits. It involved multiple tactics all at once that always was accountable to and led by the people from that housing, the people most at risk, the people most affected. Also, the cultural aspect of the movement has been really important, that cultural work is a big part of our organizing. Many of the leaders of our organizations are people like Cess45, a rapper who was one of the leaders of People's Hurricane Relief Fund, or Sonny Patterson, an incredible poet who's also a real leader in the social justice community, Truth Universal, another rapper who's an organizer with Malcolm X grassroots movements and other organizing in the city. So cultural workers have been a big part of our struggle. And if you look at the history of resistance in New Orleans, this cultural work has been an intrinsic part of it for centuries. Even many of the cultural traditions that New Orleans is famous for, like second lines, which are these incredible roving street parties / parade / barbecue that happens every weekend, these are started by these organizations called Social Aid and Pleasure Clubs, which were founded in the African-American community in the Reconstruction era as organizations to benefit the community and also preserve the culture. And the way that New Orleans culture comes out of this kind of different history of colonialism, where under French colonialism, you had free Africans as early as the 1700s, a community, a neighborhood, the Treme neighborhood of freed Africans as early as 1730. That was the oldest free African community in the country. That this community and people of the community were preserving this African and Caribbean culture as a form of resistance against the dominant white supremacist culture. Or if you go to much more recent days, our music in New Orleans, our hip hop music is called bounce music. It's also known as project music, and it came out of the housing developments, and it came out of block parties. And these block parties, if you talk to people from the community that came up in these block parties, they started because someone was facing eviction. And so people would throw a block party where everyone chips in a couple of dollars and that money would go to stop that person from being evicted. So the culture that this music comes out of is also a culture of community aid, of social aid. And the line between those is, I think, much more porous than in most parts of the U.S.
Do you want to talk about some of the cultural people who've been on the other parts of the tour?
Well, I'm extremely excited here in Portland to be presenting with Mike Crenshaw, who's a great spoken word artist and hip-hop artist from Portland who does incredible work. In a few days, I'm going to be presenting with Sonny Patterson, who's an incredible spoken word poet from New Orleans. Many people feel she is the voice of New Orleans poetry. If you listen to younger spoken word artists in New Orleans, you can hear Sonny Patterson in their words. She's so incredibly influential. So I'm incredibly excited to be working with her. And there's a lot more different filmmakers that we're showing films from, other spoken word artists. I'm really excited for all the incredible artists, media makers, activists that we're collaborating with on this tour.
That was Jordan Flaherty. Here's a piece by Sonny Patterson.
Out late on the blocks till daybreak, and they say that real hustlers don't sleep, and what's the use? It's no rest for the weary. It keeps on until it's all gone. Hustle hard, profile low, so he don't wind up on the phone. He say it's kinda hard for him to hold a job since the charges ain't expunged from. I feel your brother, but sometimes we have to slow down. Just look around and discover that we found a true gem in the middle of the wasteland. It's just too bad that precious time, it goes wasted.
Yeah, I'm kinda skeptical when I see them planes fly low. Look in the ghettos, them tend to drop loads of dope. That Ron and Coke can crack them, break they back. They gotta have it, it's a habit. No Sabbath for the addict, you know. Young cats is on the grind. Well, stand on the corner, got them nickels and the dimes. Well, street dreaming, petty pushing, small time. Too busy hustling, the note is by design. Look, all them know it's pocket got holes and money don't grow on trees. And things ain't always what they seem. She's 16, 2 mouths to feed. You wouldn't believe the sight she's seen. Kinda hard to wipe, play the scene. Erase the memories of parents, dope fiends. Enough to make a nickel scream. I mean, we gotta struggle just to keep our heads above the water. All to get in a ward for all the drama. Hot damn, another day, another holler. Work like a dog just to try and make a dollar. Well, scraping the knuckles just to get up off the bottom. Say what you say, we just trying to reach the top. And what, police coming, them sound a siren. Nothing happening, so what you want around here? You keep a circling, provoking something negative. Look, man, keep it moving, take your attitude elsewhere. Something gotta give. Look, people live in fear, say them coppers shoot to kill. Streets are the battlefield, man, it's real. Protect and serve is the motto, but them protect they say after serving niggas hollow. Tips to the head, Mr. Officer, hollow. Look, will you go to maintain this bravado? It's no difference in the cops and the robbers. It's no difference in the coppers and the robbers. But sometimes we have to slow down. Just look around and discover that we found the true gems in the middle of the wasteland. It's just too bad that precious time, it goes wasted. Yeah, so sometimes we have to slow down. Just look around and discover that we found a true gem in the middle of the wasteland. It's just too bad that precious time, it goes wasted. Mercy, mercy me. Sometimes in the city, mercy, mercy me. What it is in the streets sometimes in the city, mercy, mercy, mercy me. Sometimes in the city.
That was Summertime by Sunny Patterson.
You are listening to Circle A Radio here on KBOO Portland. Tonight we're talking to Jordan Flaherty and others involved in the Community and Resistance Tour, which seeks to communicate about current struggles for justice and liberation. The tour also seeks to connect communities of liberation and to build relationships between grassroots activists and independent media.
Again, here is Jordan Flaherty.
You know, Sunny Patterson, another really incredible part of her story. So she's the voice of New Orleans in many ways, but she doesn't live in New Orleans anymore. She's one of the people that was displaced. Now, right after Katrina, she was able to come back, you know, in the year after Katrina. But in the period after that, between trying to help her family rebuild their home, to trying to pay her own rent, which had doubled in this post-Katrina period in a lot of neighborhoods, it had doubled or gone up by more than 100%. She could no longer afford to be in this city that she loved and that she had been fighting for, and that, you know, she's from the Ninth Ward of New Orleans. And, you know, so talking to her, she talks about how you know, she's almost stunned still that she lives in Houston and that her child was born in Houston.
This is an interview with Sunny Patterson, broadcast on Democracy Now! On August 30th, 2010, for the five-year anniversary of Hurricane Katrina.
Your thoughts on this fifth anniversary? You no longer live in New Orleans. You're in Houston. Talk about what it feels like to be back in New Orleans.
Well, you know, of course, New Orleans is home. Thank you for allowing me to be on the show this morning. But, you know, we've been talking about this fifth anniversary and the difference that you feel with this particular anniversary. It's much more of a hoopla, we could say, that comes with it. It's still unbelievable to me at the same time. Yesterday we had an event in what's called Hunter's Field. We started over in the Ninth Ward and second line down to this park area called Hunter's Field. But it rained all day yesterday. And to see at the same time, again, the people stand there just to even call the names of people that they know that they have lost in the hurricane. And even as a result, after the hurricane, people that have been lost to post-traumatic stress, you know, heart attacks, cancers that have been festering, and all kinds of other health overdoses that we've been dealing with. So to see these things, and then at the same time to still see a glimmer of hope in the people's eyes, is still an amazing, amazing thing. I know for myself, not being able to be in the city full time is something that still tugs at my heart, of course. But what I do know is that, you know, we have a lot of work to do. And I know that wherever I am, I'm certainly going to be a cultural ambassador, you know, for the city to bring a light to every injustice, and even bring a light to, you know, all of the stories of hope and victory and resiliency that go on every day and every moment.
Sunny Patterson, is there a new poem you'd like to share with us?
We have not always found comfort in killers. We have not always found solace being rocked in the bosoms of those who silently pray and openly destroy. No, not always have we mistaken mimicry for mastery, or pretending for knowing, or enslavement for freedom. But across my memory marches millions bold, regal, resilient, confident, unshackled feet stumping up spirits to guide us through this fickle material world. We like sun and moon folk, universal souls praying our prayers, singing our songs, Eshu, Ogun, Shango, Yemoja, Oshun, Obatala, Oya, Dambala, Aida, Wedora, Nkango, Olodumare, and Yame. We know all of you by name. We are people of beginnings, of culture, of strength. Not always have we given in to the empty threats and scare tactics of the powerless ones. Not always have we allowed the blood of our sons and daughters to color the streets while we're walking asleep, marching to the beat of death's siren song. They're still wearing their sheets with nooses in reach, showing their teeth and smiling, it seems. But I hear in the breeze, in the rustle of the trees, in the dangling of the feet, they say, please don't let them ever forget. You see, not always have we suffered from amnesia. Not always have we forgotten how to conjure up spirits, ancestor wisdom, fix up a mixture, spiritual elixir, ancient traditions. We like magicians, God-like vision. We are people of sight, so no, not always have we fallen for this okey-doke or inhaled the hazardous smoke of the manipulators or been satisfied with crumbs from meals our hands have prepared. Hugh said life for us ain't been no crystal stair, but at least the steps are there to push us up higher, teach us how to go beyond the destroyer's disguises, look them in the eyes and be able to see. Because what's surprising when you know the nature of a beast, and especially when they've shown the same face for centuries. So you tell me, what's the difference between two sisters in New Orleans shot point blank in the back of the head and two women bombed in their car in Baghdad, or government-sanctioned killings in Kenya and a sister held hostage in a house in Virginia, or poverty in Haiti, poverty in Jamaica, rape in Rwanda or rape in Somalia, a sweatshop in China or one in Guatemala, or smallpox in blankets, syphilis in Tuskegee, formaldehyde and FEMA, ethnic cleansing and Katrina. I recall within the speech Dr. King made us aware. He said injustice anywhere is injustice everywhere, so they can spare us that drama, huh? We got the heart of them field working mamas. We carry the torch of that ancestor fire. So with every fiber that flutters in our being, with every find that comes from our seeking, with every hearing that comes from our listening, and every sight that comes from our seeing, we must be faithful, strategic, victorious, and free.
That was Sunny Patterson on the August 30th edition of Democracy Now! Again, Jordan Flaherty.
It's so heartbreaking the amount of people that are still displaced and the way in which federal, state, and city government really put obstacles in the way of bringing people back. Not only did government not help people to come back, but they really literally put obstacles in people's paths. For example, if you look at the post-Katrina period, one of the first things that happened was the entire staff of the public school system, all 7,500 teachers, as well as lunchroom workers, janitors, everyone was fired and their union ceased to exist. So that right away was a huge blow to middle-class African-American New Orleans. That was, their union was 80% African-American. So this was a huge base of people that suddenly no longer had a job to return to, that had a union, good-paying job that they should have been able to count on. But instead, they were replaced often by Teach for America people and these other programs that brought in these young white activists that replaced this black middle-class segment of the population. If you look at housing, so many obstacles were placed in the way of people coming back in housing. The main federal program to help housing come back to the city was called the Louisiana Road Home Program. Now, first of all, there was no funding at all for renters. So renters were really cut out on so many levels. And then even among homeowners, the program was found by a judge to be racially discriminatory. It gave on average 40% more money to white households than African-American households. Now, the way that happened is the formula was based partly on home values. So you could have the same home built in the same year, the same square footage, the same amount of damage done, the same amount of money it would cost to rebuild. But if it was in a white neighborhood where the home values were higher, they got more money to rebuild than if they were in a black neighborhood, even if it was the same home and they needed the same amount to rebuild. And so that 40% was oftentimes the difference that it took between people being able to come back and people not being able to come back. Similarly, if you look at public housing residents, those were folks that wanted to come back and had community and were aching to come back. But the public housing units, even though they were mostly undamaged, were boarded up by the political power structure. In fact, you had Congressman Richard Baker of the Baton Rouge area saying right after Katrina, "We've been trying to do something about public housing. We couldn't, but God did." So they took advantage of the situation to seal up the public housing and keep people from returning.
You are listening to Jordan Flaherty, the author of Floodlines, on Circle A Radio. He now talks about being part of the Community and Resistance Tour.
One thing that's really exciting is everywhere we've gone, the events have been organized by people that are organizers in their community, and they're active in local struggles. And we met really incredible people. One thing that really stayed with me was in Chicago. The struggle around, it's called the Whittier School in a mostly Latino neighborhood in Chicago. Now, this school had a building that the public school district is seeking to sell this extra building, a small building next to their main building, to a nearby private school. So the private school would have the school. The parents say, instead of selling the building, we don't have a library in our school building. Why don't you make the building into a library for our students instead of selling it to this private school nearby? So the parents, again, mostly Latino mothers from the community, started a 24-hour-a-day sit-in. I think it's still going on. It's now entering maybe its first month that they've been sitting in this building, refusing to leave and saying that they're not going to leave until the city turns this into a school a library for the kids in their school instead of selling it off to this private school. So it was incredible to meet with those parents and to hear them talk about how this struggle had transformed them.
And this song is actually about Filipino martial arts.
It's a warrior song for the warriors.
It's a warrior song for the warriors.
Parent, my son goes to school here for second grade. Actually, I went to school here when I was small. I did kindergarten, you know, up. That field house, when I was young, we used it for Girl Scouts. They're trying to take away the house that we have here, tear it down, use money that we've asked for, and with that same money, demolish the building and give it to somebody else. Right now, we're using it for meetings for the parents. We're using it for ESL classes, sewing classes, tutoring, after-school programming. It's pretty much a community thing. They said it's not structurally sound. They haven't showed any proof. It's all hearsay. We have proof from CPS and engineers that we actually contracted saying that the building was fine. I actually didn't plan on staying the entire day. I usually leave for a couple hours and come back. And we pretty much got barricaded. The police stood at the door, didn't give us much access to the outside, didn't give anybody access from the inside. I had to hear from other people that they had closed off the neighborhood, like a military siege. Nobody was allowed to enter unless they showed proof of address of whatever block this is. Actually, it started the night before. From what I hear, CPS sent over some people who pushed children, pregnant women, and pretty much scared us. So the next morning we all agreed to meet up at the house, at the field house, and we had a meeting. We started talking, trying to figure out what was going to be our next step or what we should do, because we were all very, very frightened. And a little bit after that, that's when the police showed up. We're not allowed to be in there. We couldn't take it over. It was in our property. We don't have a library. Well, we're using it for a lot of things. We do have books. We do read to the children. Well, I'd like it to stay up. I'd like to get backing from the CPS. I'd like to be able to see it grow. More projects, more activities for the children, things that we could do as a community, like we're doing now. All the money that we've gotten, we've had to beg for it. The parents have gone together, have gone to fight, and that's why we're upset too. Why are they trying to take money that we fought for? Last we heard, it was going to be used as a soccer field for Cristo Rey, which is a private school. Lots of income, lots of money. CPS doesn't really want to talk to us about anything. All they want to do is deny any of the information we get. Cristo Rey, we haven't talked to them either. Call your alderman, I know the mayor is in question right now, but call him anyway. Write letters, send emails, repost videos of any information that we have on our case. Just get the word out, and the more the merrier here. The support that we've received so far from the community has really, really lifted our spirits, made us very proud of ourselves and proud of them, and we hope it continues. Power to the people.
The Whittier Parent Committee voted to end the 43-day occupation on October 28th after receiving a written statement from Chicago Public Schools CEO Ron Huberman, stating that CPS would not tear down the community center to replace it with a turf field. Now, the parents are clear that though the sit-in has ended, the struggle continues. On their website, saveourcenter.com, parents issued these clarifications on where the negotiations stand. Number one, the location of the library has not been determined or agreed upon by the Whittier Parent Committee. Number two, the parents did not agree to the library being built inside of the Whittier School, as the letter from CPS states. Number three, the Whittier Parent Committee did not agree to be responsible for all the repairs or other maintenance issues mentioned in the letter. During the meeting, they made it clear that as the leasing agent, it is CPS's responsibility to ensure that the building is up to fire codes and safe for the children. And fourthly, they would like to make it clear that they're only ending the sit-in portion of the struggle. the Whittier Parent Committee remains in control of the field house and the programming that is currently taking place in the field house. They are not abandoning the field house or ending their fight for the library. The negotiations will continue.
I really appreciate being here in Portland and connecting with folks here. And, you know, I think everywhere in this country, there's really inspiring organizing happening. We just have to build up our communication between movements. And it's so important that we have radio stations like this that help spread the word about these struggles and connect up these struggles.